So we are in Revelation, and we're also in Advent. So that means that the joke has to have something to do with Christmas. That's just kind of a rule at this time of year. So I thought this would be appropriate. So two boys were walking home from Sunday school after hearing a strong lesson on the devil. One said to the other, "What do you think about all this Satan stuff?" The other boy replied, "Well, you know how Santa Claus turned out. It's probably just your dad." That's one you will probably tell this week, I think, because it's short and succinct and all those things. So I kind of like that thing when I say the joke and I stop and it's kind of quiet for a minute. And everybody's kind of processing it. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, that's hilarious. But anyway, we are in Revelation chapter 11. And this is the last week we're going to be in Revelation for a couple of weeks. Next couple of weeks we're going to be talking about Christmas and Advent and all those things. And then we will get back in and finish Revelation after the new year. So we'll be coming back to that. But this, we're breaking at a natural point. Revelation chapter 12 kind of starts the second half of the book, and it kind of reorients things and moves things in a different, talks about things in a little bit different way. And so chapter 11 is a good place to stop, and that's what we're going to be reading. But I need to remind you of, first of all, Revelation chapter 10, verse 11, which is the last verse of the previous chapter that we talked about last week. Y'all remember last week, right?
Yep.
Two people remember last week. So, but anyway, just remind you that this is where we ended up with this verse in John, who was told, "You must prophesy again about many peoples, nations, languages, and kings." And the reason why I go back there is because it's just a reminder that a lot of times when we read the Bible, we kind of stop at a certain point because that's where the chapter stops. But in reality, when John wrote this, he didn't stop here and go, okay, that's the end of chapter 10. We're going to start chapter 11 now and then go on and change the subject or anything like that. What we're going to see is that the next verse, verse 1 of chapter 11, is actually a continuation of this thought. So John is told, you must prophesy again. You must preach again. You must witness again. You got to keep talking to people about what I am telling you and showing you and doing here. And that's one of those things that we need to remember, that it's always like that. Now, we set aside certain times of the year, like Advent, where we want to orient ourselves around something. We want to talk about the birth of Christ a lot. Now, technically, we want to do that all the time, but the Christmas season gives us that opportunity to talk about that. And that's what we're doing when we light the Advent candle and we talk about Advent. Advent's not something that is a Protestant necessarily. I shouldn't say that. It's a lot of the more contemporary versions of Christianity don't get into this cycle of the year. But a lot of the more traditional churches, they used to build everything around the whole church year. So you started with Advent, then you go into what's called Epiphany, then you have Lent, then you have Pentecost, and then you go right around the year. And what it did is it oriented everybody around the Christian year. You talked about everything about Christianity through the course of the year. That's what it was designed to do back in the origins of the church. Because lots of people didn't have their Bible, and even if they did have a Bible, they couldn't read very well. So you did that as just a repetition, over and over and over again, talking about the story of Christ. That's what they did. That's what we should be doing all the time. We all are under this same command that John was given us. We need to keep preaching. We need to keep prophesying. And we do it to everybody. So it gives you this opportunity at Advent to remind people about the coming of Christ. Now, I've had several people ask me today, well, what is this Advent? What's going on with that? I'm trying to explain that, And I tried to explain it to those couple of people, but I'll try to give everybody, because if two people ask a question, probably 20 people have that question. So Advent means the coming or the arrival. That's what the word Advent means. And so for the 4 weeks right before Christmas, we orient ourselves around the idea that Jesus is coming. Jesus is on the way, and we're preparing for that event by thinking about the fact that Jesus comes. Now, he did come 2,000 years ago, and that's why we have nativity scenes, and we have the stable scenes, and we talk about the baby, and we talk about the wise men, and about the shepherds, and the angels, and all of that stuff. And we remind ourselves that Jesus has come. But the second part of that is that Jesus does come all the time. He comes to individuals. He comes to me. He comes to you. When we put our faith in Christ, Jesus comes. And so we have this continual coming of Jesus. He's always coming. And then the third aspect of it is it's also a reminder that Jesus has promised to come again, that he's going to return in the clouds and he's going to come back for his people. And we want to be reminded of that, which we are doing when we go through the book of Revelation, because we're talking about the events that happen around that second coming or second Advent. And that's what the word Advent then reminds us of. So every time we have four candles that we light, and then when we light the white one in the middle, that's a reminder that Christ has come. He's here. So we'll, on Christmas Eve, we light that last white candle in the middle called the Christ candle. And we talk about all the things that happen about Advent. Well, that's one of the things that I think that a lot of times we lose when we lose these traditions that we have in the past with the church, is that we just lose this idea of anticipating the coming of God, the coming of Christ in our life. And so each week we will light a candle, and as the candles are lit, we are reminded that the coming of Christ is closer and closer and closer. And that, get excited about that. Be happy about that. Be ready for that. I mean, that's the anticipation of it. Build on that. Think about that, that Jesus became a baby and died on the cross and all that stuff that happened. And we should be anticipating those kinds of things. The happiest people on earth should be those who have faith in Jesus, because we are actually celebrating something that happened, that God did for us. And we need to be reminded of that all the time. Even in the midst of all the stuff that goes on around our world. That just tells us that, yeah, Jesus needed to come. We needed him to come. Okay, that's not the sermon. That's just the... Sometimes stuff just comes out. I don't know, can't control it. So Revelation chapter 11 is a continuation. So do we still have verse 11 up there? No, this is okay. So it starts off with, I was given. Now, if we think back, and I've talked about the vision of John, and he talks about, and I've talked about it kind of almost like a series of scenes on television sets or on screens where Jesus sees a vision, or John sees a vision, and then he sees another vision, and then he sees another. Well, when that changes, when he looks from one to another, he usually says something like, after this I looked, or then I saw. And that's a code word for we're changing scenes. Now notice in this scene, or in this situation, he doesn't say that. He doesn't say, after this I saw, or I looked, and then this. He just says, I was given. And so it follows on the previous verse, which said, then I was told you must prophesy again about many peoples, nations, full language, and kings. I was given a reed. So this is continuing that thought. Whatever John's going to talk about now is still connected to this idea that John needs to preach. He needs to talk. He needs to tell people about what's going on. He needs to prophesy. And as we go through this chapter, then, we're continuing that thought. We keep that in mind. We're not changing things. We're continuing the same idea, the same thought. So it says, I was given a reed like a measuring rod and was told, go and measure the temple of God and the altar with its worshipers, but exclude the outer court. Do not measure it, because it has been given to the Gentiles. They will trample on the holy city for 42 months. Given a reed. So he's given us yardstick, essentially, something that they use to measure. And he's supposed to go measure. The interesting thing is, normally in prophets, when prophets are told to do something like this, the next two verses are him or her doing whatever she's told, he or she is told to do. So if he's told to measure, then he goes and measures. But he doesn't do that. This is all that we're going to talk about, the measuring thing, and then we're going to go on to something else. So it's kind of interesting that he's told to measure and then he doesn't measure. It gives us the idea that measuring here is not something that is something that's symbolic. What is it that you measure? That's the distinction that in the Bible that we have when God is about to do something, he talks about the division that's going to happen. He measures this and says, well, this is going to be on that side. The ones that are measured a different way or aren't measured at all are going to be on. He's dividing things. He's dividing, and God's going to, as Matthew and other places talk about, he's going to divide into sheep and goats. He's going to divide into those who believe and those who don't. He's going to divide into what God is, the people that God is going to bless and the ones he's not going to. So in the Old Testament, for example, the promised land is measured because the promised land is going to be given to Israel. And so God marks out the part that he's going to give, and he says, I'm going to set this aside. This is going to be for Israel. The rest of it's not. That's what he does here with this holy city or the temple. Here's the really thing that this is going to blow your mind. This, most people think that Revelation was written around AD in the 90s AD, about 60 years after Jesus died and he lived and died and was resurrected. Okay? In AD 70, about 20 to 25 years before this was written, the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed. So when John is told to go measure the temple, there isn't any temple. So what's he supposed to be measuring? I was really hoping you know, because then you could tell me. There's two possibilities. One is that we're still talking about a vision in heaven. And at the end of chapter 11, he's going to mention God's temple in heaven. And it's possible that he's supposed to measure that. The problem with that is that there's the division. We're going to measure the temple, and part of it is going to be set aside, and part of it is going to be trampled on by the Gentiles. So it's kind of hard to see how that applies to the temple in heaven. But there is another temple that the New Testament talks about, and that is people, us, or usins. That's how they say it in Arkansas, right? Usins. Or y'all, something like that. We are the temple. And so then this is a symbolic representation where God is saying, where I am measuring out those who have faith and those who don't. In this case, then, Gentiles means those who don't believe, those who don't have a covenant relationship with God, those who are outside that salvation that God offers. And so that's the possible, that's probably what he's talking about here. Now there is a third option, which those who are 70th week of Daniel and dispensational pre-tribulationists are, which is, I just used a bunch of big words, it's okay, which is the idea that this happens after the rapture and the Jews have rebuilt their temple and that what John's measuring is the rebuilt temple. Okay, you can read that into that, but you have to have assumed some things from other places in order to see that here, in my opinion. So what you're looking at, in my opinion, is that John is told to measure believers. Who's believing, who's not? Or another way to put it, who's supposed to be prophesying and who doesn't prophesy? Who's supposed to be preaching and who's not going to be preaching? He's dividing it. There's also this aspect to it that, you know, we could contemplate and think about, which is the idea that even though we're the temple of God, we're living in the midst of those who are not part of the temple of God. And it's kind of mixed together. And so that a lot of times in our churches, we have unbelievers who kind of trample on the things that we're doing. or trying to do. And churches face this sometimes. Anytime you stand up in front of people and preach to them, some of you are believers, some of you aren't. Some of you have faith, some of you don't. We're mixed together. Jesus tells a parable about wheat and the weeds growing together. And Jesus says, at the end of the age, which is what John's writing about, those things will be sorted out. And so I think that's what we're looking at here. John is being given a symbolic action where he sorts out who is part of the temple and who isn't. Those two categories are something that we see in Book of Revelation particularly. Those who believe and those who don't. In verse 3 of chapter 11, God says, "And I will appoint my two witnesses, and they will prophesy for 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. They are the two olive trees and the two lampstands, and they stand before the Lord of the earth." Now, I know you guys have memorized your whole Old Testament, and you, when he says olive trees and lampstands, you know exactly what he's talking about. And we don't have to go back to Zechariah and read all that stuff and talk about how Zechariah wrote the same type of things about two witnesses, because you guys all know that kind of stuff. No? The real problem is I don't have time to go back and do all that stuff. We've got only 4 weeks till Christmas. I got to get this done so we can go do some other. We got to get ready for the open house. So we got, oh, I'm just kidding. But it's a prophecy of Zechariah where he talks about two olive trees and lampstands that are standing before God and witnessing or prophesying to people. And John is saying, when you read Zechariah, and I know you're all going to run home this afternoon and read Zechariah, you will see the same type of things. And there, the two witnesses are probably the high priest, the guy named Joshua, and the king, or the person who's supposed to be king, the descendant of David, a guy named Zerubbabel. Say Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel. Isn't that fun to say? It's kind of just a great. So if you have kids coming, you got grandkids, suggest that Zerubbabel, it would be a really good name for people to have. You're not going to do that. I know. I can tell by looking at you. So that's the high priest and the king. So these two witnesses could represent that kind of thing. Before we go too much further, though, I just have to go back and talk about measuring time. You'll notice that it talked about Gentiles trampling on the court, and it says 42 months. And then here it says, I'm going to appoint my witnesses for 1,260 days. So the chart, I know you guys like maps and charts, so the chart is about time, measuring time in Revelation. Sometimes they use the phrase 42 months. Sometimes it's 1,260 days, and sometimes it'll be this phrase that's time, times, and a half a time. That's mostly in Daniel, but it is used in Revelation too. The interesting thing is that the first two are clear, but the third one is probably, they all equal the same amount of time, 3.5 years. A time plus times, two times, and a half a time is 3.5. 1,260 days divided by the year that they had, which was 360 days, you come out with 3.5 years, and 42 months is 3.5 years. So they're all 3.5 years. Good. I know you. That's an important piece of information for you to have. So the question is, there's two questions then. First of all, are these consecutive years? So it's 42 months is pointing to one 3.5 year segment, and the 1,260 days is then another one. And if you go 3.5 and 3.5, you get 7. 7's an important number in Revelation, so it's possible that they're consecutive, but it's also possible that they're talking about the same 3.5 years. That's why if you know your dispensationalism and your tribulation rapture stuff, some people say the rapture happens 7 years before he comes back because they're adding 2 3.5s together. And some people say, no, it's mid-trib because the 3.5 years are the same 3.5 years. See how complicated it is? Very complicated. We're going to take it as the 3.5 years are the what we would call the second half of the week because he's bringing it in now. We've already had 6 seals, we've already had 7 seals, and we've already had 6 trumpets. So we're already moving through this thing, and so now we're hitting, And so we got the, it's the same 3.5 years. The Gentiles will trample on the holy city for 3.5 years. At the same time, there are going to be witnesses preaching for 3.5 years. They're the same 3.5 years. And that's the, here's the kind of the kicker. It appears every time you see 42 months, that's the time that John uses to describe the Antichrist or the anti-God people. When he uses 1,260 days, he's talking about the people who are, who have faith, the witnesses, the ones who are pro-God, if you want to put it that way. So that's a little bit of a code that John uses to describe two different perspectives on the same event. It's the same time period, but it's 42 months for one, and it's 1,260 days for the other. It just gives you a little bit. If you see the 1,260 days, you can say, oh, that's a, those are the good guys. 42 months, oh, those are the bad guys. So that's the way you can kind of look at it when you see through Revelation. I just gave you the secret to the whole book of Revelation. No, I didn't, but it feels good to believe that anyway. So we have these two witnesses, and they're going to preach for 3.5 years. At the same time, 3.5 years of persecution, if you will, by the Gentiles, those who are anti-God, anti-Christ. Both are going on. And this has been true since the beginning. There's always wheat and weeds. There's always two different things going on. You know, it's one person that I read a couple weeks ago as I was reading, doing some studying for Revelation said, the interesting thing about the Antichrist is that Satan, it's somebody that Satan produces at the right time, at the end times, to be opposing Christ. Well, Satan has the same understanding of things as we do in the sense that we don't know when the days or times are going to be. We don't know when exactly Jesus is coming back. Well, Satan doesn't either. So Satan has to always have his Antichrist ready. He's always got to be working, just like we're working for God. Satan always has to be. Satan can't take a vacation and go, well, I don't think Jesus is coming back in the next couple months, so I can go to Hawaii and spend a time on the beach and kind of take a break. No, Satan's got to be ready all the time too, just like we're supposed to be ready all the time whenever Christ comes back. And so both forces are working at the same time, and it's a constant thing. There's always good and evil going against each other, that internal spiritual battle that happens all the time. And we have to remember that. Now, what we're seeing in Revelation is that as we get closer and closer to Jesus coming back, the intensity of that battle gets more and more and more as we anticipate the coming back of Jesus, which we're going to be talking about for the next 4 weeks because we're in Advent, the coming of Christ, both as a baby and also coming, the second coming. So, what's going to happen to these two witnesses? Verse 5. If anyone tries to harm them, that's the witnesses, fire comes from their mouths and devours their enemies. This is how anyone who wants to harm them must die. They have power to shut up the heavens so that it will not rain during the time they are prophesying, and they have power to turn the waters into blood and to strike the earth with every kind of plague as often as they want. Now, I know some of you are thinking, I've got enemies. It would be kind of nice to have fire come out of my mouth and burn them up. Wouldn't that be good? Kind of solve my problems, right? That's what it sounds, that's what they're going to do. These prophets are going to defend themselves. We have that interpretive choice now. I've talked about this all the way through Revelation. We got to keep talking about it. Every time we read something, we have to ask ourselves, how literally do we take this? Or is it a symbolic thing? And that's my philosophy is that generally Revelation should be interpreted symbolically unless there's a reason not to. So who are these two witnesses? Well, the part we just read mentioned a couple of things. One is it talked about the power to shut up the heavens so that it wouldn't rain. Well, there's an Old Testament prophet who did that. His name is Elijah. Elijah prayed and it didn't rain. He goes into the king and he says, guess what? You're not following God. you're not showing your faith. So until you change or until something happens, it's just not going to rain. So that's what Elijah did. He also called fire down from heaven and burned up some people. So that happened too. The other part that's talking about here is about plagues. They have the power to turn the waters into blood and to strike the earth with every kind of plague as often as they want. Well, who did that? A guy named Moses. Moses was responsible for preaching to the Egyptians, prophesying to the Egyptians, and when they wouldn't listen, water turned to blood, and there were plagues. So you've got these two individuals in the Old Testament that prophesied, which, remember back at the beginning, we said, what's John supposed to do? Continue to preach. What are these two witnesses doing? They're continuing to preach. And it says they're going to be like them in some way. So that leads people to interpret this as two individuals, Elijah and Moses, who come back. Here's the kicker part of it is, if you remember the story of Elijah, Elijah didn't die. Elijah, at the end of his life, was taken up with a chariot into heaven. The tradition, Jewish tradition is, even though the Bible doesn't say one way or the other, is that Moses, just before they went into the promised land, he went up on a mountain by himself. He was not going to go into the promised land. Joshua led them in. Nobody really knows for sure what happened to Moses, but the Jewish tradition is that he was taken into heaven also in the same way, or a similar way, just taken into heaven. So that has led people to see the two witnesses as these two individuals. Elijah and Moses come back right before Jesus does, and they preach, and they do this. It's also interesting that if you remember your New Testament, there's a transfiguration. Jesus takes on the glory of God, and two people are standing there with him. Guess who they are? Elijah and Moses. So there's a possibility that this is two individuals and that they are going to be for 3.5 years preaching in Jerusalem to people, and everybody will be hearing him. And Elijah and Moses are also not very nice people. They're pretty stern in the Old Testament. Prophets in general in the Old Testament are pretty, you know, change or die kind of people. That's the way they are. And so that's what they're going to be doing too. Now we have to talk about symbolism, though. What does Moses symbolize? The law. What does Elijah symbolize? The prophets. In the Old Testament, we divide it into the law and the prophets. So some people think the two witnesses here actually could be seen as God's word. We got the law and the prophets. We got two things that are going to be convicting people in the sense that when they read these things, it will literally burn them in their heart, and they will either change or not change. It's also possible that these two witnesses are Israel and the church. It's also possible that it's two other people, like Enoch is another person who didn't die in the Old Testament. So there's lots of choices that we can make, and there's lots of things that are going on here that we have to take into account. I'm going to turn to Malachi just a second to the very last verse of the Old Testament. Actually, the last three verses in Malachi. Chapter 4, verse 4, it says this. Remember the law of my servant Moses, the decrees and laws I gave him at Horeb for all Israel. Moses. See, I will send the prophet Elijah to you before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. He will turn the hearts of the parents to their children and the hearts of their children to their parents. Or I will come and strike the land with total destruction. That's a lot of pressure. I'm preaching to you. I'm prophesying to you. And if your hearts don't turn, God's going to come and destroy your land. See what I say? Prophets tend to be a little bit of either-or kind of people. Either you listen or you don't, and if you don't, this is what happens. But you see Moses and Elijah mentioned here before before the dreadful day of the Lord. The great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. So let's lean towards the idea that these two witnesses are actually two people, Elijah and Moses. It seems like the Old Testament indicates that before Jesus comes back, those two people would come back. Moses representing the law, Elijah representing the prophets, and that they would be the ones who are doing these witnessing. Part of that's because even though it's symbolic, and now it doesn't have to actually be Elijah and Moses, by the way. The interesting thing about the New Testament, we're going to talk about this maybe a little bit next week. I haven't decided what to preach on next week, but it's probably going to be John the Baptist. And if I do, John the Baptist was asked directly, "Are you Elijah?" And he said, "Nope." But Jesus was asked, "Was John the Elijah?" And Jesus said, "Well, yeah, he was." So in the sense, well, what you can say then is, was John the Baptist Elijah? Well, technically, he wasn't Elijah reincarnated, but he performed the role of Elijah. And so when we talk about these two witnesses, what we can say is that there are two things that perform the role of Elijah in Moses. Could it be actually Moses and Elijah? Well, sure, but does it have to be? No, it could just be two people that do that. Now, back to Revelation. Verse 7. Now, when they have finished their testimony, 1,260 days, that's when they finished their testimony, and the they is these two witnesses, the beast that comes up from the abyss will attack them and overpower and kill them. This is kind of one of the reasons why I have a difficult time with these two witnesses being something like the church, or church in Israel. How does the beast kill the church? I mean, how does that work exactly? I don't know how that would work. But you could see where the beast that would come would be able to kill two people. You could see that. So I'm going to go with the two people. Who's this beast? We haven't mentioned the beast yet. We did talk about the abyss a couple of weeks ago. That's where demonic forces come from. So whoever this beast is, he's tied into this abyss and the demon. But guess what? We're not going to figure out who the beast is for at least three chapters. So you're not going to know who the beast is until January sometime. Hopefully Jesus won't come back before then so that we'll be able to talk about it before. But the beast is, in short form, what we call Antichrist. The beast is the Antichrist, okay? That's the short version of it. So this Antichrist is going to fight against these two at the end of the 3.5 years after they preached. He's going to fight and he's going to kill them. He's going to overpower them. And in verse 8, their bodies will lie in the public square of the great city, which is figuratively called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified. He uses three different descriptions there so you know exactly what he's talking about. Where was Jesus crucified? Jerusalem. It's got to be Jerusalem. For 3.5 days, some from every people, tribe, language, and nation will gaze on their bodies and refuse them burial. The inhabitants of the earth will gloat over them and will celebrate by sending each other gifts, because these two prophets had tormented those who live on the earth. Give each other gifts and celebrate? What does that sound like? Kind of like Christmas, huh? Isn't that what we do at Christmas time? We celebrate and give gifts. And how many people are actually celebrating the birth of Jesus, and how many people are celebrating something else and giving gifts for some other reason? So you see this is just rejoicing because these two prophets are tormenting people. Go back to what John was told at the beginning. You must prophesy to all nations, all peoples. And these are the same peoples that are going to celebrate because these two witnesses are killed. It's the death. I guess God's plan's not going to work. Those two witnesses are dead. I guess God's just not going to do anything that he's promised to do. I guess it's all over with. Nope. We're going to read some more here in a minute, so don't panic, because it's not. I'm just kidding. But those witnesses are going to be overpowered. And it feels that way sometimes as faithful people, as people who try to preach the gospel. And we look around the world and we see the death and we see the violence and we see the people who refuse to believe and who work actively against God and all of these things. And we start thinking, it's just, things are dying. Well, Jesus says, or John here says, that's going to happen. Sometimes in a way more literally than we might like to think. But things sometimes do die in our life. Sometimes we are faced with death. We're faced with violence. We're faced with opposition and persecution and all of those things. And then we just have to stop and go, okay, let's keep reading. Because if we stop reading, we'll get very disappointed and lose hope and all those things. But we got to keep going. So in verse 11, it says, but after the 3.5 days, the breath of life from God entered them, and they stood on their feet, and terror struck those who saw them. Then they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, come up here. And they went up to heaven in a cloud where while their enemies looked on. Exactly the same picture of Jesus, by the way. When Jesus was in the grave for 3+ days, and then later on he rose ascended into heaven and in the clouds, and the disciples saw it. So the same type of thing, only this time everybody sees it. Lots of people see it. And it people from every nation and every... So right now we should cheer. Let's just give applause and say, good, yay, all right. They came back to life. And that's the same thing that we can say too, is that we can look back at our own lives and see our own faith at times die and places where we really struggle. And then at some point, though, we come out of it and we get back into the faith and we start seeing things in a more positive light. We do have those ebbs and flows, and it's the same thing here. These two witnesses are killed, and it's just, you know, it just seems odd that they would just lay in the street for 3.5 days and then just stand up. Life comes back. Not that happened, and that happens to us too. Those 3.5 days. The death of something that comes back to life. That's really the whole picture of Christianity. Things die, and then God brings them back to life. And that is the hope that we all have. That's the thing that we're all looking for. That's the thing that we can all put our hope in, anticipate, expectations, that things will work out the way God says they're going to. So, looking at these witnesses, looking at the temple, looking at all the things, I just want to, you're going to remember one thing as we go home today. The lesson for today, which is, before the 7th trumpet, God will try to turn hearts one more time. One more time. God is just about ready to come back. It's the last trumpet is about to blow. The third woe that we've been talking about is about to start. All of those things are going to happen. And when just before God does that, though, he measures the temple and then he sends witnesses. That's what he does. God always continually gives the message out, constantly, right up to the end. He keeps preaching. We're supposed to do that too. Take that verse at the end of chapter 10. You must prophesy to all nations, all people. That's something that we all need to keep doing. That command is to us, I think, too. In that sense, we are the two witnesses. We keep preaching, keep telling people, keep sharing the gospel, keep talking to people about the love of God and the grace of God. But there's also some aspect to it that it's easy for us to preach the good stuff, but we have to mention also that there are warnings in the Bible. If you don't live, if you don't put your faith, if you don't do this, then this is what's going to happen. This is what you're faced with. That's a much harder to do, but you can understand, sometimes, we kind of get into that idea that, church attendance isn't that good and people aren't coming to church. Well, maybe it's because, in the words of, in verse 10 there, because these two prophets had tormented those who live on the earth. Sometimes people don't come to church because they're tormented by what's being said there and what's being shown there. And that's why they don't come. And if that's why they don't come, we can't change the message just so they'll come. We have to keep preaching. And we have to keep preaching both of those things. Now, I do have to read verse, the next couple, just because it applies to us. And verse 13, it says, at that very hour, there was a severe earthquake. I just thought that was appropriate for, that was appropriate for us. We just had this severe, okay, maybe not so severe, but hey, it was an earthquake, right? Severe earthquake, and a tenth of the city collapsed. As far as we know, Roald was the only one who had damage, but a tenth of the city did collapse. 7,000 people were killed in the earthquake, and the survivors were terrified and gave glory to the God of heaven. That is a, I'll just read the last one, verse 14. The second woe has passed, the third woe is coming soon. And then verse 15 starts with, the seventh angel sounded his trumpet. And that's where we end until January. What's going to happen when the seventh angel blows his trumpet? Anticipate, hope, expectation. It's going to build. By January, you're just going to be bursting with whatever. Yeah, well, we got to stop now. But the second woe has passed. In Romans chapter 13, this is the verse that that Jessie read earlier when she lit the candle, is the reminder that during this season, you know, what our attitude is supposed to be. We're expecting Jesus to come back. We're celebrating the fact that he came the first time. We're celebrating that Jesus comes to us all the time, that Jesus is here now, and that he has come to us. And we're reminded of those things, and we want to celebrate. And in these Romans 13, it says, and do this, understanding the present time, understanding our time, the present. The hour has already come for you to wake up from your slumber, because our salvation is nearer now than when we first believed. The night is nearly over. The day is almost here. So let us put aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armor of light. You're going to leave here today, and you're going to be full of light. I want people, we should pray that when people see us, they see light. The light of Jesus shining out from us. That's what we're going to do when we pass out the communion. You're going to take the bread. You're going to drink the cup. Symbolically, that we've been talking about, you're going to take Jesus in. And we want that light that we're taking in to shine out from us. Not just for this week, but from now and at least until Christmas. just do it at least until Christmas. Maybe the new year. Let's go to the new year. That's a little bit, I know I'm pushing you a little bit, but just to the new year. Let's be the light that people need to see. Let me have the ushers come forward, and we'll pass the bread and just take it and hold it, and then when we all have, we will eat together. For I received from the Lord what I also pass on to you. The Lord Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, this is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me. The light of Christ. In the same way, after supper, Jesus took the cup, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this whenever you drink it in remembrance of me. For whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. Until he comes.